From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And this week, we've been checking in across the country on coronavirus hotspots. Today, we start with the hottest. The area around New York City is now the epicenter of the U.S. outbreak. Nearly 1 in 1,000 people in that region are infected, 5 times the infection rate in other parts of the country. Governor Andrew Cuomo saying today it's doubling every 3 days. WNYC reporter Gwen Hogan is in New York. And Gwen, we heard Dr. Deborah Birx yesterday. She's with the White House Coronavirus Task Force, say that 28% of tests in New York came back positive. That's compared to 8% positive in the rest of the U.S. How did it get this bad?
Well, you know, we live in such a dense environment, New York City, and we also have people coming and going from every country on the globe up until a week or two ago. We're congregating in concert halls, museums, public transit. And for weeks, as this outbreak was spreading across the world, travel was only restricted from China. Mm. And we were not testing for the virus here, really, until the last week and a half, if we've been able to do that. So the numbers we're seeing now are the result of weeks of community spread of the virus, to the point where it's all across the 5 boroughs.
Well,
now.
And your governor, Cuomo's hair's been on fire talking about this. New York has since ramped up its testing capacity. Cuomo said New York is now testing at the same rate per person as China or South Korea, which did very well in this. So how did New York manage to get those tests?
Well, we know that the city and state have partnerships with several commercial laboratories in the area, and many of our hospitals, which are some of the most sophisticated institutions in the country, they also have in-house testing. So that partly explains why we've been able to ramp up this testing. But having said that, New York City last week just had to walk the requirements back on who can be tested, even as we have more testing coming online. And that's because we have such severely restricted personal protective gear. And each time you take a test, you have to use fresh gear. So now New York City is saying you should only be tested for the virus if you need to be admitted to the hospital. Everyone else is going to be told to recuperate at home anyway. And so in order to conserve that, the protective gear, the masks and those things that are in short supply, we want to do as few as tests as possible. So that may also explain why we have such a high percentage of positive tests coming back.
Hospitals are being ordered to increase capacity. You had the first prisoner test positive at Rikers Island. I'm assuming in the few seconds we have, the city's ramping up.
Yes. I mean, hospitals are facing an unimaginable strain right now. The governor said yesterday that hospitals have to increase their capacity by 50%. They already had plans to discharge patients who didn't need emergency care and cancel elective procedures. But even with clearing out that space, it's still nowhere near the 50% they're now mandated. So we have pop-up hospitals coming online, the floating naval hospital, but that's nowhere near 140,000 beds the governor says we're expected to need in the coming weeks.
Just amazing. Gwen Hogan with WNYC in New York. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, stocks surged this morning on expectations that the Senate is closing in on a $2 trillion coronavirus relief package. Senator Jeanne Shaheen, Democrat of New Hampshire, joins us now. Senator, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks. It's good to be with you in this very stressful time for families and I'm sure all of your listeners.
Well, and President Trump has been saying in the last couple of days, we can't let the cure be worse than the problem itself. When you see so many people losing their jobs, industries faltering, talk of a recession or even a depression, are you worried that the cure could be worse than the disease itself?
Well, that's why we've got to act very quickly here in Washington to help those people who are being laid off. But we've got to remember that the most important thing we can do is to defeat this coronavirus, to help people both stay healthy and get healthy again, because until we've gotten on top of this disease, people are not going to want to go out to restaurants because they're going to be worried about whether they're going to contract the disease. So that is the most important thing we can do. And that's why it's so important that as we pass this relief package here in Washington, that it includes very robust provisions to help our hospitals so they can treat those people and they don't get overwhelmed. We have a number of hospitals, small hospitals in New Hampshire who are in financial difficulties now because they've suspended all elective surgeries, and they're trying to treat the overwhelming numbers of people who may be infected with the coronavirus. So we've got to make sure they get the help they need and that the medical workers who are on the front lines get the help they need.
So when is that stimulus package going to pass? Will it pass the Senate today?
Well, I hope so. We worked late into the night last night. I've been working with the leadership of the Small Business Committee. Senators Cardin, Rubio, Collins, and I have been working to try and get help for small businesses to make sure that they can get loans to stay solvent so that they can continue to pay their workers. Those loans would then be paid back to them if they kept their workers on board. We want to make sure that workers can continue to get their health benefits. So we are very close to an agreement. I believe that Senate-wide, we're close to an agreement, but it's got to be an agreement that helps workers. We don't want to see what happened after the financial bailout where we helped a number of big corporations, and they didn't pass that help along to the people, their employees, the people who were on the front line. So we got to make sure that that happens this time.
So will there be corporate bailouts in this package as well, do you think?
I do think there will be help for certain industries. Certainly the airlines are in big trouble, and we want to make sure that they get the help they need. But we want to make sure that it's done in a way that ensures that the people who are working for the airlines actually see that help, that it doesn't all go to stock buybacks or executive bonuses. So I think that has been a negotiating point, and I do think we're very close to an agreement, and hopefully we're going to hear soon what that will be. You know, I want to make sure that workers out there who are being laid off get the help they need, that local governments that are on the front lines of dealing with this crisis, that we provide some help for them, that we help the hospitals and the medical providers who are really dealing with this crisis, because that's where the help, I think, is most needed.
Senator, finally, let me just ask you, in all of the crises that you've dealt with in your life and career, does this compare to anything?
I think this is the worst crisis that I've seen in my political career and probably in my lifetime. It reminds me of the stories that I heard from my parents and grandparents about the Great Depression and about World War II. And in that respect, it has the same element of it's affecting everyone in the country. And so we all need to remember that. We need to try and help each other. We need to be mindful of what the medical guidance is, to stay out of crowds, to wash our hands, if we're feeling ill, to stay home, because this is going to get better for each of us when it gets better for all of us. And so we've got to work together to make that happen.
That is Democratic Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire. Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, today, the head of FEMA said that for the first time, the Trump administration will trigger and use the Defense Production Act, drawing up contracts to pay private companies to produce thousands of COVID-19 test kits. But President Trump is doubling down on the possibility of loosening social distancing guidelines soon. As Jeremy just said, the president saying we can't let the cure be worse than the problem, despite his own Surgeon General warning yesterday that this week it's going to be bad. NPR political correspondent Scott Detrow is here. And Scott, for many, this came out of nowhere. So is there pressure on the president to loosen restrictions after the 15 days of social distancing? They're going to be up next week.
Yeah, well, there's certainly different kinds of pressure here. There is the most important pressure to slow down the transmission and the mortality curve, which means sticking to the restrictions, maybe even strengthening them. But President Trump is clearly hearing from people worried about the long-term economic impact of a shutdown or a slowdown. And you have heard him suddenly shift gears and repeat the same few points in recent days. That line about the cure not being worse than the problem, and that we can do two things at once. Earlier today, White House economic advisor Larry Kudlow said he thinks President Trump wants to do something in the next 2 weeks in terms of reopening the economy. The idea of reopening places that are not hot zones, as he put it, in order to help the economy. Of course, that would be directly contradictory to public health experts and many of the governors who actually imposed these restrictions.
Well, his expert, Dr. Deborah Birx, was with the president yesterday at the task force briefing. What's been her reaction to this?
Well, she repeatedly stressed the importance of social distancing, of sticking to this initial guidance of keeping a distance, staying at home as much as possible during this 15-day national window. It's worth pointing out we're only a little more than halfway through that window, and now we're talking about getting things started again. She was asked directly a few times whether she agrees or disagrees with this new push. She did not weigh in on that directly. She only said that she and other experts are continuing to look at evidence and will be giving the president information as the White House decides what to do next.
By the way, a Democrat has also talked about fine-tuning this. New York's Governor Cuomo floated the idea of younger people maybe going back to work, older and more at risk, continue to be isolated. But what are other Republicans briefly saying about lifting these restrictions soon?
Well, Cuomo also said that the curve is still getting worse in New York, and it's only going to get worse. You've seen a little bit of pushback from unexpected places like Liz Cheney, a top House Republican, saying the economy is not going to get better if so many people are still sick or in danger. But there's been a lot of agreement as well. The question is, does this suddenly harden on party lines what would be a public health conversation?
Yeah. Scott Detrow covers politics for NPR. Scott, thanks so much as always.
Thank you.
This message comes from Here and Now sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. That's why you need Indeed.com. Post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates using an intuitive online dashboard. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free at Indeed.com/here now. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply. Offer valid through March 31st, 2020.
The coronavirus outbreak is testing leaders around the world, including President Trump, who has downplayed the crisis and says it won't last as long as public health officials believe it will. Let's bring in Julian Zelizer, who's professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
And we come to you for historical perspective, and every day this feels like it's more going to be a part of history, a big part of our history. Is there any other moment that this compares to as you look at it?
Yeah, for me, it really does remind me, although it's a pandemic, of the Great Depression, where the bottom falls out of our society and economy. Things get worse for a while, and it lasts for a long time, and created the Great Depression in the 1930s, the same kinds of social anxiety, fear, depression, as a result of what was happening to the nation. And I think that's really similar to what a lot of people are feeling, although now people are feeling that in isolation. So we even lack some of the resources people could draw on in the 1930s.
And when we think about that moment in our history, one of the quotes that pops into my head is FDR saying the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. How do you think President Trump is rising to this moment?
I think he's coming rightly under a lot of criticism. He sent many mixed messages about what needs to be done or what was happening. He was slow to respond. He's lacked a clear plan of what's going to unfold in the next few weeks and months ahead. And he hasn't used all the resources that he has available to him. And so I think many governors in both parties are looking at Washington, and they're not seeing the kind of strong leadership that they really need for this kind of crisis from the White House. And they also have a president who is not listening to healthcare experts. And this is a time you can't simply dismiss expertise.
Well, and in fact, it has been the governors who have been the ones that have been shutting things down. President Trump is talking about whether he's going to reopen the economy earlier than the health experts say. But in fact, it's the governors who have been closing things down. Are you seeing governors rising to a level of leadership that we haven't seen before in this crisis?
They are. And this is also like the early part of the Depression, where you have strong governors step up. And you've had in New York, Governor Cuomo, Governor Baker, DeWine, Governor DeWine in Ohio. There's been a number of figures in both parties who have taken tough actions. They've closed down, public interaction, even though that was unpopular. They've been very straightforward about what was happening in a way that differs from what you hear from the Oval Office. And they're showing management in a time of crisis. So governors are doing, I think, a very good job. But on their own, I don't think they're going to be able to handle this.
Julian, you know, you talked about World War II and the Great Depression. I wonder also if we should be looking back to what the 1910s were like, because you had not just World War I, but also the last major pandemic on this scale, or at least it looks like it could be on this scale, which was the Spanish flu in 1918.
Yeah, 1918, I've talked about this in various places, was a pandemic that was comparable to what we're going through today. I mean, we didn't have the kinds of medical resources that are available, but it caused the same kind of disruption. It caused massive amounts of casualties, and it totally wrecked American society for a long time, and it was global in nature. So I think in terms of health and a healthcare crisis, that's another important moment, although the question is, does this last even longer than that did in terms of the impact here on our domestic life?
Do you think that this is going to have long-lasting effects? I mean, if you look right now, even at traffic in this country, there are major cities that people would spend hours getting to and from work. And right now, so many are working from home. There's no traffic. People are starting to realize that they can do things maybe a little differently that they might stick with in the long term. Do you see long-lasting effects from the momentary disruption?
I do. I think the memories from this moment, this is so severe, will never go away. I think it is like the generation of the 30s that was scarred from seeing the economy fall apart so dramatically. I think we're now going to be cognizant not only of big holes that we have in our public health process and in dealing with these kinds of pandemics, but some of the ordinary social actions we didn't think of in terms of health will be on the table in years to come. And so I don't think this ends, we go back to normal and everything resumes. I think there are going to be long-term discussions once we're out of this about things that need to change.
I wonder even about things like shaking hands, hugging people when you see them. Will we go back to that so quickly?
I think so. I mean, we won't actually. I mean, I think there will be an impact. And I've written, I remember how my grandfather who lived through the Depression, a lot of what I heard from him in terms of making sure you eat all your food and never leave anything or watching your money because you never know what's going to happen. That became part of his life until he passed away. And I think as I look at people who in their 20s and 30s who are living through this, I think even a handshake is going to look very differently, or even going into a very crowded area will look very differently when this is over. And it will be part of their life and part of changes that we see in decades ahead.
That is Julian Zelizer, professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Julian, thank you as always.
Thanks for having me.
Well, worldwide, there are more than 390,000 coronavirus cases, and the death toll now tops 17,000. Spain today announced more than 500 deaths, the worst single-day total since the outbreak started. Joining us now is the BBC's World Affairs reporter, Naomi Grimley, who is in London. Naomi, let's start in Spain. We're hearing about an ice rink being used to store bodies.
That's right. In Madrid, they have laid aside an ice rink as a temporary morgue because they are worried about the sheer number of bodies that they're having to deal with. It's overwhelmed the funeral parlours in the city. In fact, we've also heard that the municipal funeral collecting service has temporarily been suspended because there are worries that the staff who go and collect bodies are not properly protected. In addition to that, there have also been rather grim reports of soldiers going into nursing homes and finding elderly people abandoned and left for dead in their beds because the staff have run away afraid. So a very grim picture from Spain. And we've seen footage from inside some of the hospitals in Madrid where patients are lying on the floors, clearly not getting proper treatment.
Mm-hmm. Well, and Spain is the country with the fourth most confirmed cases in the world. What are the other countries' health officials are focused on right now? What are you hearing?
Well, of course, everyone is trying to upscale their testing capacity. Remember, the World Health Organization is absolutely insistent that the way forward with this is to test, test, test. That is their mantra. So, for example, Spain has imported over 600,000 testing kits. These are ones that should be able to tell if people have developed some kind of antibody immunity to the disease. And France is also supposed to be looking at the way that it goes about testing. One country that has tested a lot is Germany. So far, their death toll is relatively low compared to Italy, Spain, France, and the UK. At the moment, Germany appears to have only 112 deaths, and their mortality rate is 0.4%. One of the reasons why that might be so low, though, is because they are doing large-scale testing. So they may be picking up, in percentage terms, they may be picking up more cases of the milder variety.
And what about where you are in the UK? Last night, the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, made this announcement that there would be new restrictions. He wanted everybody to stay home. No more gatherings of more than two people allowed. But many people thought he should have done that long ago. How are people in the UK reacting?
There has been an about turn from the British government. It came about a week ago. They were originally quite relaxed about continuing to let most people go about their daily lives. And then suddenly last Monday, some new research from Imperial College London really shocked the government into an about turn. And that's when they started to suggest that older members of society perhaps stayed at home and those with serious underlying health conditions shielded themselves away for 12 weeks. Then last night, as you mentioned, Boris Johnson introduced dramatic measures that the like have never been seen in peacetime. These include things like you're allowed to leave your home for one form of exercise a day, but just you on your own. If you do it with someone else, it's supposed to be someone from your own household and you're not supposed to meet up with others. Also, big restrictions on the number of people going to work. The government is clearly trying to dissuade anyone who doesn't need to travel for essential reasons, particularly in the capital. They don't want them getting on the underground. And we have, unfortunately, seen pictures of the underground still packed in the morning, partly because the authorities have cut the numbers of trains. But that then means the trains that are running are packed, and some of them are actually carrying health workers.
And we should note that you are joining us from home and I am joining you from home. So that's a sense of where we are right now. The BBC World Affairs reporter Naomi Grimley in London. Thank you.
Thank you.
Want to add more positivity to your podcast feed? Check out Kind World, stories of extraordinary kindness and compassion.
That's Kind World. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen.
So we know more Americans are staying home, and we know restaurants are taking a serious hit. As we reported yesterday, the National Restaurant Association says the industry could lay off 5 to 7 million employees over the next 3 months. But as NPR's Isabella Gomez Sarmiento tells us, food delivery workers are keeping busy.
It's a warm spring afternoon, perfect weather for enjoying a meal outside. That's usually what would be happening on the patio of Croagh Street Market, one of Atlanta's most popular food halls. But today, the tables are completely deserted. Most restaurant booths have signs indicating that they're either closed or only serving food to go. But there's still foot traffic. Raymond Neville is a driver for Uber Eats. He hurries in to grab orders and get back in his car.
In the last 2 hours, I've done about 15 deliveries, which is more than normal.
He says that's been a pattern for the last couple of days.
I'm just washing my hands. I have hand sanitizer in the car, so I'm taking my own personal precautions. But yeah, hey, it is what it is.
About half of all states have placed limitations on restaurants. No dining in allowed, only takeout, delivery, and the occasional drive-thru. The new rules are part of the nationwide effort to flatten the coronavirus curve. President Trump recently encouraged executives from all the big fast food chains, like Domino's and McDonald's, to agree to close their dining rooms. That means more people stay at home, but it doesn't mean orders have to stop rolling in.
It's picked up.
Justin Willis is also a driver for Uber Eats.
Yeah, the money is definitely more than it normally is.
He says he's not too worried about potential exposure to the virus.
I'm taking a lot of precautions, gloves, wipes, and I just go in and out. I don't touch or talk to people.
The company these two drivers work for, Uber Eats, recently announced they'd be providing drivers with sanitization products. Willis and Neville say they're using their own for now. Other drivers coming in and out of restaurants wear gloves and wipe down door handles before touching them. Some people tell me they don't want to be interviewed for sanitary reasons. And some drivers worry that continuing to deliver will put their health at risk. Online groups are getting involved, too. Hashtag PayUp, a campaign for gig economy workers, is demanding that companies like Instacart, DoorDash, and Grubhub take more precautions to protect their drivers, many of whom can't afford to stop working because of the coronavirus. So far, there's been some response. Uber recently updated its sick policy to say it'll provide up to 2 weeks' financial assistance to drivers who are diagnosed with COVID-19 or placed in quarantine by public health authorities. Postmates says it's also offering to help with medical expenses. Stephanie Session, who has been delivering with Uber Eats for about a year, is picking up an order at Patria Cocina.
Have you been worried at all about having to expose yourself by still going out and delivering?
No, because I'm not that close to them when I just hand off the food and go.
She says most people are choosing the contactless delivery option to leave food outside their doors. And to her, more orders and better tips makes the work worth it. It's unclear when restaurants will fully reopen, but workers like Session plan to keep delivering as long as orders keep coming in. And there may be more drivers soon. DoorDash is rolling out a new priority access program for in-house restaurant employees who would like to start delivering during their unexpected time off. Isabella Gomez Sarmiento, NPR News, Atlanta.
So, what are you doing at home? Are you ordering out? Are you perhaps buying gift certificates for your favorite restaurant so they can have the money up front and maybe you'll take advantage of the certificate down the road when this passes? If you're a restaurant, how are you being innovative to stay afloat? Let us know. HereAndNow.org.
Scientists say one reason it is so difficult to control the spread of COVID-19 is that many infected people show only mild symptoms or no symptoms at all and don't know that they're contagious. Jeffrey Shaman has been looking into this. He's a professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia University's Mailman School, and he joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me, Jeremy.
So your research published in the journal Science this month found that 86% of all infections that happened before China instituted severe travel restrictions in late January were undocumented. Does that mean that 4 out of 5 people who were spreading this disease had no symptoms?
You know, it's not that they didn't have symptoms. They may have had mild symptoms, sort of like the crud that you and I would experience with, you know, maybe a sore throat or chills or a little bit of a body aches that are associated with getting a mild respiratory illness. But it's not the type of thing that actually slowed them down. So they may mostly, for the most part, have experienced some symptoms at some point, but it didn't keep them home, didn't stop them from getting on public transportation, going to work, going to school, getting on airplanes and going on business trips.
But you say that they were a major driver of spreading this disease.
Yeah. So what we found was that 85%, 86% actually, of people were undocumented infections, meaning that they mostly fell in this category of mild symptomology and still going about their business. We also found that per person, these people were a little more than half as contagious as the people who were admitted to hospitals or sought clinical care. So while that on a per person basis, they were less contagious, because there's so many more of them, they actually contributed to the vast majority of the spread. We can actually take the model that we use to make these inferences and identify these numbers, and we can then shut off their ability of these undocumented infections to actually spread the disease at all. And what we find when we do this is that 80% of documented cases disappear as well. So these silent spreaders are going out in the community and they're distributing the virus and they're setting up chains of transmission where a lot of people are subsequently becoming infected and they infect more people. And the majority of those infections are in fact mild and are not people who then would then go and seek medical care. And this is very consistent with what happens with a lot of the seasonal viruses that circulate around, things like rhinovirus and influenza and the endemic coronaviruses. The majority of the infections are undocumented. People don't feel the need to go see a doctor. And as a consequence, we don't know that they're there. Those people don't stay home. They go about their business. They engage with the community pretty much as they normally would, and they spread it broadly.
So how do you deal with that? Is the only way to deal with that to just test everybody?
You know, that's what some of the societies in the world have done. So what the Chinese did when they implemented these strong control measures on January 23rd is that they basically, you know, restricted travel. They shut down schools and businesses. They had everybody stay home. They enforced it forcibly. And they did a lot of contact tracing. So they did a much more aggressive campaign of swabbing people to find out where the infections were, making sure those infected persons really stayed isolated, and engaging in finding who their contacts were and quarantining them. The South Koreans did the same thing to very good effect when they had the outbreak in Daegu, which is their fourth largest city. And they were really informed by their prior experience with MERS, which is a related virus a few years back. Mm-hmm. And this actually proved to be effective. But the measures are very strong. They're somewhat draconian. You know, the information that we hear is that people, that the officials were going into people's credit cards, looking where they'd shopped, looking where they'd gone around, and then going to those locations and finding people who had been in contact with them potentially and testing them. A very aggressive campaign to identify where the virus may have spread.
How did you determine these numbers in your research? And do you think there's any possibility that you could be overestimating the effect of these, quote, silent spreaders?
Well, you know, it's certainly possible. Ours is one study of this. The way we did it is that we're modelers. We make a mathematical model that describes the transmission of the virus in a way that we think represents reality. In this case, we represented the transmission within and between 375 cities in China. We informed that model with observations and movement data, and then we try to run what's called an inference problem and estimate those critical parameters. Here, what fraction of the people are undocumented, what fraction of infections are undocumented, and how contagious are they? The reality is it's consistent with what we see in terms of the spread of the virus and how quickly it moved geographically, both within China and outside of China. Now, there is the added wrinkle that there is pre-symptomatic shedding of this virus, but our model actually does implicitly capture that. We've also applied it to the United States in a slightly different form. And here, where testing is less, we're finding actually only 1 in 11 people are being documented. The other thing is, after the travel restrictions are imposed, our same model estimates that about 2/3 of people were identified in China when they were in this period of much more active contact tracing and using of tests.
So given all of that, what do you think that the U.S. is doing right, and what do you think that the U.S. is doing wrong? I think of President Trump saying, well, I'm not going to get tested because I haven't had any symptoms, which, according to what you're saying, wouldn't matter at all, because you could either not have symptoms or you could be pre-symptomatic. But yep. In terms of how the U.S. is handling the virus, what do you think?
Well, I do think there are some things we could do better. Look, the main issue here is that we're dealing with a very challenging virus that unfortunately is very dangerous for the world at large. And it is so because it has three ingredients that come together to make it so. Firstly, it's an emergent novel respiratory virus to which the majority of the population, if almost 100%, are susceptible to it. So those susceptible people, which is you and me, are the tinder that allows this to spread like wildfire. The fact that it's respiratory also allows it to transmit very efficiently. People don't necessarily have to overlap in time and space in order to have transmission, because somebody can walk into a room and to deposit the virus on surfaces in the air, and then somebody can come in later and actually pick it up from them. The second thing is that it has these mild infections that support the stealth transmission. The majority of people who are getting infected are not documented, and they're spreading it in the community unwittingly. And the third thing that makes it very dangerous is it has this fat tail, where the symptom output is, in some instances, the symptoms for people are very severe, and it's causing high rates of mortality, which is incredibly problematic. In order to deal with it, you really want to get out in front of it as quickly as possible. testing is a really effective way of doing it, particularly early in an outbreak. Doesn't mean you want to do it willy-nilly, but it means that when you identify people who are infected, you want to find out who they were in contact with, quarantine those people. If they begin to manifest, test them, and then test their contacts as well. The difficulty is that in a place such as New York right now, where I live, it's gotten kind of out of hand. And the question is there the capacity? Are there even the swabs available to conduct testing at the level we would want to try to flatten that curve and bring it back down? And that's the challenge that we're facing right now.
Let's say that I go to the supermarket. It's one of the only places I go now, but occasionally I will have to go to the supermarket to get some food. If somebody breathes near me, can I get this virus from that? Or does it really have to be that somebody's gotten some saliva or a droplet of moisture onto a piece of fruit, I touch that and put my hand on my face?
The answer, unfortunately, is that we don't know. One of the outstanding questions and issues associated with all respiratory viruses is that we really don't know the mode of transmission, that is, the way in which they are transmitted and which one is dominant. We know how they can be. We know they can be airborne. We know it can be droplets, people spraying each other in the face when they cough or sneeze or speak or even breathe. We also know that it can be that some of those droplets settle on surfaces that somebody else comes along and touches, and then they eat a cheeseburger, they rub their eyes or whatnot, and they're going to transfer it to themselves that way. Those are the three main routes that we're talking about for viruses like this. We don't have good evidence to even define how flu is transmitted. This is something that's hotly debated and has important implications for the control of the virus. We don't know the answer to that for this. So the question for the grocery store is to be careful, to wash your hands afterwards, wash your produce, and try not to get too close to people as you're moving around when you're having to expose yourself in situations like that.
That is Jeffrey Shaman, who's a professor of environmental health sciences at Columbia University Mailman School. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Be well.
And by the way, some people who have no symptoms or just mild symptoms of coronavirus have been reporting that they are experiencing a loss of their sense of smell or taste. A British doctor who's seen a number of people with just those symptoms tells the Washington Post that she hopes by raising awareness, she'll stop some of these silent spreaders of COVID-19.
As we said earlier, today the head of FEMA said that for the first time, the government will trigger and use the Defense Production Act, contracting private companies to produce thousands of COVID-19 test kits. This Korean War era act is something that governors have been pleading for, but President Trump worried in a press briefing that it would make the U.S. like Venezuela, which nationalized industries, took them over. This act does not do that. It allows the government to ask companies to make things and then guarantees them pay. Jim Walsh is here now, security analyst with MIT's Security Studies Program. Jim, we want to talk to you about national security, but just your thoughts on actually triggering this act. Do you think it's going to help?
Yes, I do. I mean, right now we have 50 customers, the 50 individual states that are all competing against each other and against other public and private customers for critical public health supplies. And this act, which was passed in 1950 during the Korean War, allows the federal government to intervene and control the production and or the distribution of those critical goods critical to U.S. national security. In the 50s, we used it for steel and mining, and now we're going to use it for masks and test kits and some other things. But it gives the government broad authority and all sorts of different tools, from wage and price controls to loans and incentives, to try to goose the production of critical supplies that are in shortage.
Okay, to national security. Is this pandemic now affecting ours?
I think it has, and I think in ways that are both positive and negative. So what are the, you know, let's get some good news on the table here. I think the risk during a pandemic, a global pandemic, the risk of war, the risk of armed conflict in general declines. At least the use of ground troops, you know, countries are focused on their domestic situation, and they may have to use their militaries as we have in the U.S. to carry out civilian tasks. And then in addition, you know, one of the traditional motivations for conflict is you go grab someone else's territory because you think it's valuable. Well, that's complicated if that territory is filled with cases of coronavirus. Mm. So and war fighting, in a practical sense, is very difficult. So for the duration of this phase, I think armed conflict in the world is probably going to decline. People are going to stay indoors. They're not going to fight.
Yeah. Well, what about the risk from countries that could pose a threat to the U.S. before this outbreak? North Korea, Iran. We know there's a terrible outbreak in Iran. We don't know, you know, if we can trust the numbers from the government there, but the numbers are pretty high. Do we have a clue about North Korea?
Yeah, it's a great question. I've been worried about this for a while. North Korea, as you allude to, officially denies that it has any cases, but acts in a way that suggests that the virus is there. And it's inconceivable that it's not there. It's smack dab right next to China. But they've announced quarantines. They've announced the construction of a large hospital. You know, that tells me that they have cases. And they have a notoriously shaky healthcare system, arguably the most vulnerable, if only because of U.S. and international sanctions. But I assume China must be helping them out of self-interest, if not humanitarian motivation. But we just don't know the state of it. And as you point out, in Iran, it's ravaging Iran. Iran is, you know, up there with Italy. It's one of the hardest hurt. U.S. sanctions have undermined the humanitarian effort there because it's hard to get goods in there. Talk about shortages. And interestingly, the most at-risk group, it seems to me, in Iran, you know.
Oops. Wait, don't leave us hanging. The most at-risk group in Iran is? We'll have to see if we can get Jim back to fill in that blank. But, of course, Iran, I'll start filling in some of these statistics. Iran has more than 24,000 confirmed coronavirus cases, more than 1,900 deaths. We spoke recently to a reporter. We can link you up to that story at hearnow.org. He'd been detained there, and he said that the government is just not transparent. So do we have Jim Walsh back?
Yeah.
Yeah. So no problem. But so you were saying the most at-risk population in Iran is?
Is the older clerics. I mean, these folks who are in group settings and who are up in age, it's true of everywhere, but it's true of them. And they're the group that's in charge. Now, I don't think that's, you know, I don't know what internal implications that has. But it's definitely going to shake things up. I think in the short term, both North Korea and Iran are going to hunker down. They're not going to be looking to pick fights in the middle of a crisis. But they're going to come out of this, and they may be angry, and they may be desperate. And, you know, that could lead to maybe a negotiation, but that could lead to conflict, too. So quiet during this period, but could be bumpy once things pass over, if they pass over. Some of the things that may cause countries to be cautious here is we may get a second wave, right? In the fall,
in the winter,
sometimes
yep.
with these sorts of things, you get a second wave. So I don't think anyone's going to have an itchy trigger finger, either Iran, North Korea, or anyone really, given all the uncertainty about where this virus is headed.
Oh, wouldn't that be something from your lips if, in fact, it could, in fact, flatten out, along with the curve, flatten out some of the conflicts around the world. Jim Walsh, Here Now security analyst. He's with MIT's Security Studies Program. Jim, fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you. Be well.
You too. And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. Robin, that was like, and the one thing you need to do to solve the crisis is...
Is what?
This is Here and Now.